Good morning, Judy Kennedy here with an hour of Bush Telegraph on RN and Radio Australia. Today we'll hear why New Zealand farmers are very happy with the results of their country's election. They think they've dodged a bullet in the form of new legislation. We'll define nature deficit disorder for you. It really exists, and it's all about how we connect young people with the environment. We'll ask what the Country Women's Association will do with $18 million that's just arrived in their New South Wales coffers. And we'll visit an historic sheep station in South Australia. It's celebrating its 150th birthday, and it owes a lot to the wonderful paddle steamers of the Murray. Hello. Hop on board. It's an easy ride. Stay listening for the next hour to Bush Telegraph. First to real estate, though, in Sydney today, because as I mentioned, the Country Women's Association has just sold its head office and hostel in the highly desirable suburb of Potts Point. You might know it. It's just next to King's Cross in the heart of the city. The property was bought by the CWA in 1953 when Robert Menzies was Prime Minister and wool was making £1 a pound. So as you'd imagine, there was some concern about the decision to sell it. And one person who's been following the story with interest is senior journalist with The Land newspaper, Roderick Makem. Good morning.
Good morning, Judy. Thanks for getting in touch with me.
Roderick, it's good to have you with us. Tell me firstly about this building in question. What's it look like? How big is it? And why did the CWA decide to sell?
Well, it looks much like a building put together in 1953 in that sort of blocky 50s concrete style, but it's a very large space for that part of Sydney, about 1,300 square metres, and obviously, prime location in Sydney real estate. But being an older building, maintenance costs were really stacking up, and in the end, the CWA just had to decide whether or not they were going to be paying roughly $3 million in maintenance and upkeep, or if they were going to sell it for a substantial amount, and they decided to go with the sale.
How popular was the sale? Did they take it to was this a statewide vote or a national vote?
It's purely a state issue for New South Wales, for the CWA here, and at their annual conference back in May, they took it to a vote there of the I think it was roughly 500 delegates who attended that meeting, and they voted to sell it then with I think about 73% of the delegates voting in favour. However, it was still quite an unpopular decision. And a group of the delegates who attended that conference put together a motion for a special meeting to be held next month in Dubbo to rescind that sale decision, and then it was sold anyway. So I think that process there is what got a lot of members upset.
I see. Yes, I did see a quote in The Land that a CWA member had said there's a total lack of transparency and a lack of respect for grassroots members. Now, we asked CWA New South Wales President Tanya Cameron to come on the program and she declined. Was the fact that this was an unpopular decision with around 30% of members who voted due to the fact that they felt the connection with that building? What was it used for? Was it for country families?
There's obviously a long-standing connection with the building, and that mostly is down to the accommodation that was there available for country members to come into town if they were attending hospital appointments or visiting kids at school. It was, again, a prime location right in the middle of town for people.
Mm. I was interested to see, too, in the Financial Review, I think they quoted that a member could have a double room with ensuite, and keeping in mind this is in Potts Point, for $100 a night, where if you look on What If, the full rate for Potts Point ranges from $300 a night to $1,000 a night at the Holiday Inn.
Yeah, definitely. I think definitely the main concern people had with the building being sold was that they were going to lose that accommodation option, that cheap accommodation option in Sydney. The main alternative put forward was that the money used from the sale would go to buy a new office headquarters that would not include accommodation, and there would be something put together with a deal with a local motel or something like that, where they might get a cheaper rate. However, I don't think it was ever going to be as cheap as what they were getting at that Potts Point building.
Mm. So was there a lot of interest in the property when the CWA decided to put it up for sale?
Well, it all happened very quickly. What we're told is that there were about 15 expressions of interest. However, it then went from expression of interest stage to tender process very, very quickly, within a week, I believe. And then was sold while many members still thought they were heading off to attend a meeting next month to rescind the original sale decision.
And what did it sell for?
It ended up selling for $18.4 million, which was an excellent result for the CWA.
That's a phenomenal amount of money, $18.3 million.
And it was more than they were expecting to sell it for. At the meeting in May, they were talking about getting maybe $12 million for it. So a really substantial result there.
And who bought it, Roderick?
It was bought by a private Chinese group, and that's as much as I know about them, beyond the fact that I believe that they are planning to develop the site into for a residential development.
So what of the CWA? And I mean, you know, looking at this, you said that 70% earlier in the year voted for the sale and 30% thought they could still have an extraordinary meeting at the end of October. Now the building's been sold.
Mm-hmm.
This is a practical decision that comes to organisations, be they the CWA or be they Macquarie Bank. You know, you have this old real estate in the centre of the city which becomes extraordinarily valuable, and CWA's got them all up and down the coast. It was very... it was good of them to look to the future and have those places for country people to come and have their medical appointments and look after their kids and that sort of stuff. But now we're looking at Sydney with $18 million. That's going to make for a very flash office for
it
the CWA.
Is. And without wanting to speak for the CWA, but with that extra money that they have received there, I think if they were able to use that when they're looking at buying a new site, if they could include, if they haven't now have enough money to include accommodation, I think that a lot of the arguments against the original sale would certainly die down. But obviously that hasn't been decided yet.
Mm. It's an interesting one too, because in Sydney, $18 million really doesn't buy you a lot. Unless
it depends whereabouts you go in Sydney, I suppose. They could look a bit further west than right in the centre of town.
For sure. So, just finally, is there anything dissenting members can do, or is this done and dusted?
That, I suppose, would be the $18.4 million question. As I mentioned, a lot of the delegates who were all preparing for an emergency special meeting next month to debate rescinding the sale decision. When I spoke with them last week, they were all at a bit of a loss about what now was going to occur at this meeting, if they could still even go ahead with the motion to rescind. And if they can, how would that relate to a building already being sold?
Mm.
And so, when I spoke with the CWA members last week who'd been... putting together this special meeting, but they literally didn't know what was now going to happen with that meeting and whether or not they could still do anything about the sale.
And could I just ask you, out of interest, were they the older members of the CWA, so could be expected to have a historic connection to the building, or were they young up and comers?
Most of the ones I spoke to had been long-term members, and it's I think a common theme was that. Yeah.
Good-o. Thank you very much for your time.
No worries, Judy. Thanks for getting in touch.
That's Roderick Makem, senior journalist with the Land newspaper in Sydney, speaking about the CWA's sale of their head office in Potts Point in Sydney. $18.4 million it earned for them, sold to a Chinese bidder, and we will stay in touch to see what happens with the CWA's investment in a new head office somewhere in Sydney, I'm sure. Just ahead, we'll speak across the Tasman to find out what the view of farmers is to the results of the election held recently.
Ever since Stanislavski, actors have been delving into their psyches method acting. Another technique, though, is purely physical.
I may not be feeling anything, pain or whatever, but I'm actually, to the audience, exhibiting that emotional state. And then I can just walk away from it.
How the body activates emotion and cognition.
When I began this, it was like watching a magic trick.
The Body Sphere, this afternoon at 1 on RN.
I think Amanda Smith would be boogieing in the studio with that background music, wouldn't she? Well, New Zealand farmers, our friends across the Tasman, have dodged big environmental reforms after the Conservative National Party was returned to power in Saturday's election. They returned with an outright majority. Voter support was apparently down for the opposition Labor and Greens parties. They campaigned on introducing new taxes. Water and carbon were their directions. For a farmer's view of the election, Lucy Barber spoke to William Rolston, who's from the farm lobby group in New Zealand, Federated Farmers.
Well, I think farmers around New Zealand are actually breathing a huge sigh of relief from the election outcome. I mean, we were faced with a Labor-Green government which was going to give us an avalanche of taxes and regulations that were going to mean that farming was going to struggle.
What sort of regulations?
They were looking at a water tax, a carbon tax, and a capital gains tax, which were all going to have a significant impact on agriculture, which even the Labor government in Australia never even contemplated putting a tax on, put it bluntly, sheep and cattle, burping and producing methane. That's what the tax was going to be on. You're talking about taxes on electricity.
What's specific examples, though, of the sort of regulations and taxes and how they'd work in terms of what the Labor-Green government would have wanted?
The one that was going to affect farming the most was a water tax. So this was going to be a tax on water that farmers used for irrigation. And that was going to be used around New Zealand in terms of dealing with any water quality issues. The problem is that 62% of the irrigation is done in one province, which is Canterbury, and another 28% in its neighbour province, Otago. For Canterbury alone, the sort of level of tax that was going to be put on those irrigators was going to equate to about 13% of the Canterbury GDP. That would have been crippling for farmers.
What promises did National make to farmers throughout the election campaign?
So one of the things that the last National-led government wanted to put in place was reform to the Resource Management Act. Now, the Resource Management Act is a planning act to balance the economy, the environment and social issues when you're making decisions about whether you're going to build something or develop land. And that needs some more balance in terms of balancing the economic opportunities and costs with the environmental one. At the moment, planning procedures are extremely litigious. Communities will actually be able to sit down and say what it is they want out of their environment. Where are the bottom lines and where should we be heading?
So it sounds like your government is pretty keen to reduce red tape. Is that a fair summary?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. We've moved from talking about red tape to talking about green tape. You know, you have to realise that in New Zealand we have a very, we see ourselves as being very environmentally savvy. But our view of that is probably different to the rest of the world, and our standards are quite different. So while we talk about environmental issues, the rest of the world is looking at us and saying, well, actually, your environment's pretty good. And what we're saying is we need to make sure that we don't compromise our environment, but we need to be able to run our businesses at the same time.
If the Greens and Labor have less power now, National has a lot more, and National is pretty keen to cut red tape and reduce regulations for farmers. How can you guarantee that farmers will go about trying to reduce methane emissions, for example, and ensure that rivers and lakes aren't polluted by dairying and so forth? How can you guarantee that farmers are on the front foot when it comes to environmental issues?
Well, if you look at greenhouse gas emissions, it just makes sense to be reducing your greenhouse gas emissions in terms of the intensity. That is the carbon intensity, the amount of carbon dioxide you produce per kilogram of product. And New Zealand farmers are actually the most carbon efficient protein producers, animal protein producers in the world. What it would mean is to keep improving productivity. If you improve productivity, you generally improve product profitability. So in doing that, you're actually everybody's heading in the same direction.
Yeah, they're heading in the same direction as us, aren't they? Improve productivity and profitability. They're the key words. I think, in farming sectors right around the world at the moment. That's the president of New Zealand's farm lobby group, feeling a bit happier today. Dr. William Rolston from Federated Farmers, who was speaking to our political reporter, Lucy Barber. We'll have more rural news headlines in a moment, and then we're going to be talking about a disorder. I'll let you see if you know what its name is. It covers the hypothesis that people, especially kids, are spending less time outdoors, and that results in a wide range of physical problems as well as mental health and behavioural issues. I wonder if you're outside today, because it's a cracking day in the south. I'll be with you in a minute. Tony Allen's here in the studio with news headlines. We'd both rather be outside, wouldn't we?
Yes, it's an interesting time if you happen to be at a grain terminal, because the Agriculture Minister, Barnaby Joyce, has released the mandatory code of conduct governing port access. Now, as they say on Facebook, it's complicated, but...
Well, port access is the key, isn't it, if you're an exporter?
What this is all about is how much you should pay to get access to another company's grain terminal at a port, so you can send your grain overseas, and it's worth a lot of money to the companies that own the grain ports, and to the companies that export grain. It's a little bit like the Telstra situation, where the other carriers have to rent their lines off Telstra because Telstra owns the lines, and there's always an argument about how much you should pay and how much this should be regulated. In Western Australia, which is the big grain exporter, the grain growers there want total deregulation of the ports, so the government just gets right out of it. On the other side of the country, they want plenty of regulation to make sure that the monopoly wheat exporters don't control the whole thing. So if you don't know much about grains, think of it as Telstra and Optus and all the other carriers, and they're having a similar sort of fight. In Western Australia, they want total deregulation. They're not going to get it. This report does continue to impose quite significant costs on the grain terminal operators, ranging from $300,000 a year in some cases to only about a tenth of that for CBH in Western Australia, which adds to their push
advantage
for deregulation.
Yeah.
Jeff Honey of the Grain Trade Association is disappointed that these regulations are going to cost some terminal operators $300,000 a year, and he says those costs are going to be passed on to the farmers.
That will be another cost of doing business, so that will go into the expenses of all port terminal operators, and also keeping in mind that the exporters will also be involved in there to a certain degree, so that will be another cost of doing business, and that will be reflected in prices that they pay for grain.
Yeah, wrestle for the profits.
Yeah, it doesn't help at a time when the grain prices are falling.
Yeah. Now, conditions are going from bad to worse in parts of New South Wales, where the drought is still having a stranglehold.
Yeah, well, look, we've got a bit of mixed weather news today, because up in Queensland, central and western Queensland, they had some good rain overnight, up to 70 mils, and that was a great relief. In fact, it's the best rain they've had at this time of year for years, apart from floods, so which they don't want. This is proper rain. But further south, it's pretty grim. Last week, 60,000 Merino sheep were sold at the September sale in Hay. Now, that's a hell of a lot of sheep that farmers had to get rid of because they didn't have feed for them in the surrounding districts. And Graham Morfitt, who farms at Booligal near Hay, says the rain is desperately needed.
The knife is hurting badly at the moment. Around Hay, particularly if it doesn't rain the next month, there'll be no feed going into the summer. North of Hay and the Saltbush, we've had a good season. It's very tough going into the summer for the Hay Plains.
You only have to hope for rain, because a lot of those people, well, I know a lot of people in southern Queensland were also feeding sheep to get them through the winter, but if you're still feeding now, your bill's going to be going through the roof.
There's a little bit of rain forecast for later this week in that region.
Now, an Australian dairy company signed a big milk deal with China.
Yes, this gives you an idea of how big potentially the Chinese market is. The Bega Cheese, based in southern New South Wales on the south coast, and also owns Tatura Milk in Victoria, it's signed a $100 million deal to a Chinese supermarket chain, the Chongqing General Trading Group, to supply long-life milk over the next 5 years. Now, the Chongqing area in southwest China, most people haven't heard of it.
I haven't heard of it.
It has 29 million people. It's probably the biggest city in the world that nobody's heard of, you know, if I can put it that way. Oh, obviously the Chinese have heard of it. But Bega Cheese says that they've had to rearrange a lot of things to make sure they can send 20 million litres of long-life milk there every year for the next 5 years. So that's quite a breakthrough there. And the Agriculture Minister Barnaby Joyce led a trade delegation to China last week, and there were dairy people among them. So they're hopeful that there'll be more deals coming out of that.
Yeah, 29 million people, you'd have to be happy getting a deal into there. Thank you, Tone. Tony Allen brings us rural news headlines every day around this time, and you can also check them on the website, abc.net.au/radionational, and just head to Bush Telegraph to see some beautiful features as well as all those latest rural news stories. You're listening to Bush Telegraph on RN and Radio Australia. Judy Kennedy with you today and tomorrow. Cameron's out and about gathering stories. You probably find, like me, that there's a term for everything these days, particularly when it relates to children. Have you heard of nature deficit disorder? It's the term that covers a hypothesis that people, especially kids, are spending less time outdoors. And some people reckon that results in a wide range of problems, whether they're physical, mental health or behavioural. So is nature deficit disorder, NDD, real? And should we be concerned about it? A couple of people who firmly believe in it are here to talk about that. Wendy Goldstein is a lecturer in sustainable development at Macquarie University in Sydney. And Sue Lennox is co-founder of AusGreen, an organisation based in beautiful Bellingen in northern New South Wales. Good morning to you both.
Hello, how are you doing, Jim?
Very well, thank you. I hope you've got a lovely fine day today, spring day.
Well, actually, we've got a lovely, slightly damp day, which is even better, bearing in mind that we've got a water deficit disorder at the moment up here.
That's always happening in some part of Australia. We were just talking to Tony Allen, actually, about the big sale of sheep in hay, and those poor things are desperate for a drop, but it's the same on the coast, is it, Sue?
Yeah, look, it's, you know, we've got rainfall this year is well below what it should be, and so we're very thankful for each little drop that comes along, particularly at this time of the year when everything starts to grow again.
Well, I guess that's something that you're trying to teach young people too, isn't it, if you're trying to reconnect people with nature about the value of rain, the actual dependence of everything on the climate and the weather. And you're both involved in a new project. It's called Regeneration. Wendy Goldstein, talk to me about, for starters, nature deficit disorder before we get on to regeneration.
Well, it's actually a global movement that's been started from the US, and it's been picked up a lot in Australia. There's a lot of organisations now trying to get kids out into nature called Nature Play and such, because it seems so important for young people just to understand themselves, be able to understand how to take risks and manage their own play. So it's really free play that they're talking about. But the other issue is that there's a concern that, you know, if we don't actually develop a relationship with our bush, then we won't really care about it in the future, and that seems to be very important as we see progressively a lot of the environmental legislation sort of becoming more threatened with changes of governments.
Is there then a difference in this generation that's growing up now to generations that have come before, and why would they be less connected with nature?
Well, Planet Ark did some studies. It's an NGO. They've looked at the actual incidence of children going out into nature, and definitely since my age, which is, you know, the elder group, we played a lot in nature and had free time. The indication is that the children aren't going out and having the free play. They're having less hours outdoors and more time probably indoors and looking at screens. And, you know, there's some associations with, is that meaning that children are less active and therefore, you know, contributing to some of the weight gains that are happening with kids. But it's also about that freedom, I think, and exploration and discovery and excitement about the world they live in.
Well, you are a lecturer, as I said, in sustainable development at Macquarie Uni in Sydney. What's your experience with your own children or children around you? Do you see them getting out and about?
Well, my children certainly, yes, did get out and about, but unfortunately they were living mostly in Switzerland. It wasn't quite the Australian bush, but they were certainly out and about, yep.
If you look at your friends in the office, are they people who actually make an effort to get their kids out into nature?
Well, I've got a pretty unusual office. It's a group of environmentalists, so they're all pretty keen on the environment and getting out into nature.
You're preaching to the converted there.
I'm not a very good sample to to look at, really. Yeah, but this whole project started because of the World Parks Congress, which is coming to Sydney in November. And it's a 1 in 10 year international event where people who work on protected areas, national parks and so forth around the world are coming to talk about, you know, how to care for these into the future.
Yes.
And one of the areas is actually being discussed is how to inspire the next generation with nature, based on this work of Richard Louv in the States about the nature deficit disorder.
Mm.
And so, you know, when that discussion was going to happen in the World Parks Congress and we said, well, how are we going to inspire young people? It seemed to me that the best thing to do was to ask young people, well, how would we inspire your generation to go out in nature? And because young people are so concerned about the world and the future, we think that by engaging them in coming up with solutions that we're, you know, empowering them actually, enabling them to be change agents and help them get over this concern that they have that things aren't going as well as they might hope. So we hope through the project that young people come up with ideas, we can mentor them, look at, and sort of guide them through a process of being a change agent. They learn skills for their future life and career, develop a confidence about trying to work with other people to bring about change, and we want to explore with them, you know, what their project does and what effect it has. So that's the basic idea, and then to connect that to the World Parks Congress, get them to come along and talk about their ideas at the Parks Congress, meet other people from around the world who are trying to get young people back to nature and learn from them and develop their own projects even further with us.
Well, Sue Lennox, your organisation, AusGreen, is partnering with Macquarie University and you're helping out with this research, this project called Regeneration. How do you inspire kids around Australia to get involved?
Good question. Look, AusGreen has been working, you know, in the space of inspiring young people and engaging young people to tackle the challenges of these times, you know, particularly the environmental ones that we face, and get involved in creating the kind of world they want to be part of. And, you know, what we've found works, and I guess what's really exciting for us about the partnership with Macquarie University is to have the research to track that. But what we have found works is, you know, it's really important to have that first-hand contact. It's really important for young people to have the space to be able to understand what's going on in the world, so they're coming at it from an informed position. And then the other one is it's really important for them to be able to generate their own ideas and then see them through. And it's in that process of, you know, generating their own ideas that they really do, you know, inspire themselves and inspire other young people and their whole communities and community leaders.
So how did you go about, in terms of grassroots connections, asking young people to step up? What do they have to do to be part of Regeneration?
There's two pathways. There's a whole group of young people that AusGreen is already working with nationally, but particularly we're focusing in on the New South Wales group. And then the other pathway is that Macquarie University currently has an invitation out to the wider public in New South Wales. If there are young people that would like to get involved, they can actually nominate over the next week or so.
Just in New South Wales?
Just in New South Wales, yes.
Mm. Well, it's one of the most heavily populated states, so I guess if you start that movement for change there, you'd see the ripple effects. Do you think if we're talking about ripple effects, that this affects the wider consciousness of being out in nature? Because we're talking about children and nature deficit disorder because we want the next generation to be aware of what they can do and how important it is to be connected. But do you find that perhaps middle-aged people who are working a lot more now and staying in the workforce longer forget about that connection too?
Absolutely. And Wendy, you know, forgive me, you know, we're up here in Bellingen. A group of Bellingen youth ran a program they called Festival for Our Future a couple of weeks ago, and Wendy came up to do the research for it, and she made the comment that, you know, after 36 hours here, she felt like she'd been away for a week and felt totally refreshed, you know, to be back out in the natural world again. And I think that, you know, in our busy lives, it is very easy as adults to get, you know, connected to screens and forget the importance of actually being out in the world, and that we are completely dependent on nature for every breath, every drop of water and every morsel of food that we eat.
Mm. Yeah, the other thing we've found too, the ABC runs a Haywire program. It asks regional youth to talk about their experiences, and they put up projects. We were talking to some last week about a anti-racism project that they'd set up, but we find that those young people are coming forth with ideas that adults mightn't have considered, and then you do start getting a whole lot more young people on board, and that's the way you drive the change.
Absolutely. And look, you know, it sounds like a great opportunity for partnering with Haywire. When young people, I mean, look, I just think as a society we completely underestimate their capacity, and I am frequently blown away by what they do and what they achieve.
Me too.
And so, you know, ignore them at our peril, but ignore them at our loss probably more specifically, because they have an incredible contribution to make at this time. You know, they're the ones that have the most to lose and the most to gain. About the changes that we need to see in terms of protecting the earth at this time. And, you know, my experience is only of just finding an incredible intelligence and passion that, you know, constantly amazes me.
One of the projects that you've been talking about was based around the Bremer River in Queensland, and we have a wonderful young person who's come forward to talk about what she thinks and how she feels about regeneration. But first I'd like you to tell me about the Bremer River in Queensland. This is Sue Lennox, who's the co-founder of Ausgreen.
Well, we were invited by Ipswich City Council and the Bremer River Fund to come up there. You'll be aware that the Bremer River was very severely impacted by two 1-in-100-year floods.
The floods. I still remember seeing the Ipswich mayor, and they did such a wonderful job, but boy, they got wiped out by those floods.
Yeah, absolutely. And so the Bremer is on the radar, but particularly, you know, part of what we do at Ausgreen is get young people involved in citizen science. So we got the young people from Ipswich out doing an entire whole river basin ecological and social survey to investigate the health of the river. And you know, what we saw in that time is that, you know, across the river basin there's been massive land clearing, and so it's no wonder that when we get a severe weather event, a severe rain event, that rain is just running straight off that open landscape and into the river. There's nothing there to keep it, to keep the water on the land, which,
and to slow it,
you know,
down.
We all know is absolutely critical, slowing that flow down and letting the water sink into the land so that it will be there to, you know, nurture nature, but also to nurture agriculture in the region. So that came out as a really big concern for that group of young people, as did very high phosphate levels in the river. I have to say, you know, I've been doing this kind of work for over 25 years and I've got the highest phosphate level I've ever seen in the Bremer River earlier in the year.
Mm.
And, you know, it was thousands of times above the Australian standard. And at the same time, very high, very low oxygen levels. And so, you know, that's going to really hamper the capacity of species that live within the river to and that underpin the entire river ecosystem to be involved. So all of the strategies that the young people involved in Mar River Bremer developed focus on those three things.
Well, let's cut to the chase because Tia Hacker's on the phone. Good morning.
Good morning.
And we're speaking with Tia because she's a Year 11 student at Bundamba State Secondary College in Ipswich, and she was involved in the Bremer River projects. Tia, how many of your classmates worked with you on this and what did you do?
Hi. So there was about nine of us from a geography class, and we were expected to attend a compulsory water testing day. Throughout the day we tested different chemicals within the river, like Sue said, the phosphate levels, dissolved oxygen, and then we were, we all got together and we discussed the results, and it was quite interesting to see the high phosphates and why the river was so unhealthy. So then a few of us expressed interest in that, and we decided to make some action plans, which we would work with Ipswich City Council and Ausgreen to help improve the health of the river.
What I'm interested in is what you knew about the river before you got involved. Did you just drive over the bridge in Ipswich and go, oh yeah, there's the river, the old brown sludge? Or were you interested? Did you kayak on it? Did you notice? Did you play in parks next to it? Or was it just not on your consciousness?
Yeah. Well, Ipswich City Council has got a lot of river parks along the side of the river. And when you're driving past them, they're not really getting used too often. And after speaking to a lot of people in my class, a lot of people feel that the river is so unhealthy and dirty that nobody wants to be around it anymore.
I could understand that. How did you go about trying to change people's attitudes once you had your results from the testing in?
Yeah. Well, a lot of people were actually interested in why phosphate levels were so high and how come that was. So we thought we would make an action plan to spread the awareness around school, so we got into someone's primary school.
Sorry, you got into the primary school?
Yeah, we got into the primary schools and we were talking to them about
phosphate. Did you?
Yes.
And what did you tell them, that the river's dirty and we need to take more care of it?
Well, we do. We wanted to get across that you want to be the change that you want to see in the world. So we are explaining to people that when you're buying dishwashing liquid, although you may think it's very unharmful, on the back you need to look and see if it's got phosphates in it, because they're dripping down your drains and going straight to the river, which is increasing the phosphate levels, which is not very good for the river.
So the kids can tell their mum and dad when they go home that they really shouldn't be doing that. Do you think that would then have the ripple effect we've been talking about?
I think it will have some impact on it, not directly, but definitely in future.
Someone told me you ran a Bremer brekkie. What was that about?
We did. So one of our action plans is to get awareness around the community. So we ran a brekkie river day, and it was hosted at one of the parks along the river. And we invited schools, parents, local politicians, and basically we took them down to do some water sampling and getting some results, which what we did on the first day, getting into the project. And also we discussed some of the results that we found at schools and spoke about how come they are so high and what can we do to prevent it and where we go through from here.
And in the wash-up of that barbecue, the Bremer brekkie, what did people tell you around town? Because I'd expect that your immediate friends and your immediate school groups would be really enthusiastic about this, but sometimes it can be difficult to get, you know, the people down at the local bowling club to get on board, or maybe a whole heap of tradies who work in the area mightn't think that it's a priority for them.
Also, I think the parents that attended from the students that did the water testing were actually really surprised at the high phosphate levels and other levels within the river. And I think that we sort of got our message across that we need to do something about it and it's important, and hopefully that the parents take this on to their friends and spread the message around.
So you'd be hopeful of going to the World Parks Congress, I'd guess.
Sorry, what was that?
I guess you'd be hopeful of going to the World Parks Congress that Wendy Goldstein was talking about. She was telling us there's a 1 in 10 year conference that's coming to Sydney later in the year, and I think the winners or some of the real performers in regeneration will be going to that congress.
Yes, definitely.
Good on you, Tia. Sue Lennox, what difference do these activities make then on a grander scale, not only in the local community? Can you reduce those phosphate levels?
Look, and I'll just also make the comment that, you know, last week Tia was down in Canberra with the 12 young people from Ipswich presenting at the International River Symposium. And, you know, so they were actually presenting the outcomes of their work, you know, to an international audience in that symposium. And, you know, very, very impressed with the quality and the standard of their presentation. And, you know, adults were, like professionals that always work in this space, were pretty astounded at how much they'd achieved, you know, in the first 6 months of them being involved in the program. So, I think that the ripple effect in terms of, you know, not only the importance of engaging youth, but young people being educators of their communities.
Well, they also don't have assumptions yet, do they? They don't sort of think, oh, no, I couldn't swing their point of view, or I couldn't do that, or I couldn't do this. They just slip out and get into it.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think in the process, you know, they discover a lot of potential, you know, TMA comment on this, but, you know, in the process of designing their own ideas and seeing them through, they, you know, they reconnect with nature in one way, but they also discover things about themselves that they never would have thought possible.
Mm, well, yes, regeneration is the name of the project, and it would certainly fire up people, children, to believe that they could be agents for change. Wendy Goldstein, I'm wondering, you're going to be surveying too, I think, young people about their experiences and attitudes to nature. Are you surveying city and country kids about that?
Yes, we'd be delighted to have country kids. The project's funded by the New South Wales Environment Trust, and it's about increasing understanding of biodiversity, or the diversity of our nature. So it's sort of focused on catchments, so our mountains, our rivers, our wetlands and our coasts. So they're the sort of areas that we're trying to look at for young people to come up with projects about how to reconnect people into those sorts of environments around New South Wales.
What are some of the more novel connections that you've heard of already in terms of getting public involved?
They're coming up with social marketing. Some of them want to work on the transport minister. They're really interesting ideas coming through the pipeline. So we're looking forward to getting a few more in and making our selection and starting to work with the young people to help mentor their projects.
And in terms of TIA's project on the Bremer River, are you going to be following their progress in terms of reducing the contaminants in the river and maybe cleaning it up and getting more public involved?
Well, we'd love to. We've sort of got this focus on New South Wales because of the funding body, but I think that the wonderful thing will be if this just sort of rolls out all through Australia, of course. And we're hoping after the World Parks Congress to sort of, you know, get the movement rolling more dramatically through New South Wales, and then hopefully it spreads over the borders into other states. So I think having people like Tia around as an example for other young people is fantastic, and I thank her very much for telling us about her project today.
Absolutely. Well, we'll look forward to hearing from the World Parks Congress, which is something we'll cover too in Bush Telegraph. And I thank you all for your time.
Pleasure. Thank you for your time.
Best of luck, Sue. Good on you, Tia. That's Sue. Wendy Goldstein's the lecturer in sustainable development at Macquarie University, Sydney, the last voice you heard. And Sue Lennox up in Bellingen, Chief Executive Officer and co-founder of AusGreen. And Tia Hackay was talking to us from the Bundamba State Secondary College in Ipswich, doing some great work on the Bremer River. You're listening to Bush Telegraph on RN and Radio Australia.
Week 3 of the Life Matters Exercise Challenge.
It's already getting quite hot out here in central Queensland.
Meet Annalise, high school teacher, mother of two.
I felt great after I did it. Today I'm in a lot of pain, but I'm proud that I stuck with it.
And Clayton in Wollonga, father of three.
Vigorous walking, couple of hours surfing. Last week I came down with the flu, so I kind of lost 3 days.
And his partner, Ali.
Clearer in my thinking and inspired, more creative.
Take the challenge on the Life Matters website.
Oh, sounds like such a lot of effort, doesn't it? Now, listen, I'm sure you've probably read a lot of interesting stories about how the interior of the country was opened up to agriculture, and we've got one for you today. You know, the ones, the great cattle drives, all the stories of droughts and floods and tragedy. Well, if you went to Chowla Station in South Australia's Riverland, you'd be able to hear lots of those stories. Over the weekend, the station marked its 150th anniversary. And funnily enough, unlike many other properties that are similar ages, the family that settled it have managed to hang on to it. Remarkable. Stephen Schubert was at Chowla for the celebrations, and he spoke with fourth generation owner Jock Robertson, who's just passed the property on to his son.
My great-grandfather came up here as a young lad in his teens when he came up with his two brothers in 1864, and the property had been taken up by their stepfather Richard Holland on the 8th of February 1864, essentially to give his stepsons, the three lads who were late teens, early 20s, a chance to get their hands dirty.
What would have been here 150 years ago?
It was all pretty well natural land as it was when white man first came here. There'd been no development on the property. The property was known as the Bookmark Leases or Bookmark Run, and a bloke called Albemarle Cator had it. He did nothing with it, and I'm not sure whether it was resumed or he gave the leases up. But from the stories that my ancestors have passed down to me is that Richard Holland became aware that these leases were available, and he had a lease in the what's now the Loxton area called Bukpenong. And while he was there, he heard about these leases and he came up with his overseer to have a look over the land with the idea of taking it up for his three stepsons. He came up with his overseer, and this is a story that's been related down the line from my family, that they came up and he decided to take it up and was preparing to go on to Adelaide, to the government offices, and take it up. Anyway, they camped, he and his overseer camped near on the very close to Lake Bonnie near Barmera. And that night, the overseer, after Richard had gone to sleep, he let all but one of the horses go and took off to Adelaide to take up the leases in his own name.
So the overseer did the dirty on him?
Well, he tried to do the dirty on him, but Richard woke up the next morning and realised what was happening and managed to catch one of the horses and took off in pursuit. And the story relates is that he changed horses at Morgan, where, of course, he was very well known, and he continued on through Gawler and on to Adelaide, went through the night, and arrived at the government offices and was able to go up there when they opened up the next morning, and conducted the deal and secured the leases. And as he's walking down the steps, the overseer was walking up and apparently tipped his hat at him and kept walking.
Too late, mate.
So that's how the Robertsons became established on Bookmark Station.
Well, I have talked my way into the wheelhouse of the paddle steamer Marion.
My name's Neil and I'm the master of the Marion.
Neil, at the moment you are standing on one side of a wheel which is, I don't know, a metre and a half diameter at least. It's huge.
Close to two.
Describe for me where we are and what we're doing.
We're up here at Chowler as part of their 150th anniversary celebration. We're also on an extended cruise. We've been out for the last 11 days. We've got one more to go. Currently we're just out on a bit of an hour jaunt this afternoon.
Now the Marion, I understand, is actually a passenger ship, not a wool ship, but what can you tell me about the history of it?
Marion's dabbled in a few things in her time. She was originally built as a trading steamer or a hawking steamer, and they were set up like mobile stores at a time where there was very little in the country towns and things. So a boat like the Marion or the Kookaburra or any of those, the Queen, the big trading boats, they would rock up and they'd have all the haberdashery and groceries and anything else you needed for day-to-day life. And that was the first bit of her life. She was then converted into both a passenger and cargo carrying steamer, so she could do both jobs. And then by the 1920s she was basically in the passenger boat role, right up until the 1950s. It'd be one of the last commercially operated paddle steamers on the river in a time.
You are here for the 150th anniversary of Chowler Station, but a property like Chowler just wouldn't have been able to survive 150 years ago without the paddle steamer industry.
No, certainly not. You could put your wool on a bullock team that could take anywhere from 6 weeks to 12 years to get to one of the one of the major seaports for export overseas. And steamers like the Marion here, they could have it down to a place like Morgan in a matter of a couple of days, And the equivalent work of a boat the size of Marion and a big barge is about 27 semi-trailers in one hit.
This is a question for the skipper that I don't know what you're going to say, but the eight-year-old boy in me would not forgive me if I didn't ask, is it possible to have a go on the whistle?
Yeah, we'll give her a tootie already. Here you go. Pull that.
Thank you, Skipper. You've made me very happy.
No worries, mate.
Oh, that's Stephen Schubert indulging his 8-year-old boy. Wow, just takes you there, doesn't it? That's the toot of the paddle steamer Marion. Beautiful, huh? What a beautiful story. That's from the 150th anniversary celebrations at Chowler Station. It's in the South Australian Riverlands. Stephen Schubert was our reporter. It's owned by the fourth generation of Robertsons to live there, which is a pretty impressive record. I loved that thing about the station owner beating his overseers to Adelaide to secure the property and just tipping his hat to him as he walked down the stairs in victory. You can see the beautiful pictures from Chowler's anniversary celebrations on our website, abc.net.au/radionational. This has been Bush Telegraph. We'll have the news next and then the world today.
Last week on Me, Ricky and Him.
It's bad poetry. Why would you want to expose our audience to it?
Unthreatening, and there was a lack of warmth.
She tries to make an effort, but sometimes that's just not enough.
The second-rate, talent-free co-host.
It could be another word for doll.
Really looking forward to working with you, Ricky.
Me, Ricky and Him. A radio show about a radio show. Download from Radiotonic at the RN homepage.